Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In California, employees are allowed to take leave due to a variety of reasons and circumstances, from bereavement to caring for a loved one, medical leave, bonding with a new child, which includes adoption. This year, a new state law adds another type of absence for hopeful parents, allowing employees to take unpaid leave following a reproductive loss. It does include miscarriage, but it also means much more, from a failed adoption to surrogacy and IVF transfer, as well as other fertility diagnoses. CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf has more about this new California law and joins us now. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Vicky.
So how did this new law come about?
So Senator Susan Rubio put this law forward this past legislative session to reflect something she was hearing from more women in her district. So according to the Mayo Clinic, about 10 to 20% of all pregnancies end in miscarriage, although that number is estimated to be higher when including people who never know they're pregnant. But Rubio says that figure is not reflected in state law.
It's normal. And I think for many years, it felt like women did something wrong because they couldn't carry a child to term. And it's not their fault. It's not their fault. Just like it's not if we have IVF that failed, a failed adoption, it's just part of life. And we need to recognize not only the trauma, but also that it's okay to talk about it and no one's to be blamed.
So Senator Rubio really wanted and felt like it was her, responsibility to make sure that reproductive loss law was added to the California books.
And it takes effect this year. I touched upon some of the reasons, but can you run through the types of reproductive losses that qualify for this new leave of absence?
So the law covers miscarriage, unsuccessful assisted reproduction, so something like IVF, in vitro fertilization, not taking, failed adoption, failed surrogacy, a diagnosis that negatively impacts pregnancy, a diagnosis that negatively impacts fertility, or stillbirth. And it applies to both people in the couple. So if you have IVF that doesn't take, if you receive news that you won't be able to ever have a child, all these things count as an allowance for bereavement and healing and would qualify for these 5 days.
Given that we already have a variety of types of leave, why don't the other leaves like bereavement qualify or fall short?
So yeah, bereavement covers the loss of a child, parent, sibling, grandparent, grandchild, domestic partner. So that seems like a lot of people, but there's, a lot of folks that you can lose and lose a child, a prospective child or the possibility of a child or a fetus, and that is not included in bereavement leave. Employees also have sick leave, but employers are only obligated to give 3 sick days a year. I think that's changing, but that's not a lot of sick leave. Pregnancy disability leave covers if you are truly disabled due to pregnancy complications or the loss of a child. So if you are someone who probably still could work, that pregnancy disability leave doesn't cover you. And the last leave that could cover but doesn't fully cover is the California Family and Medical Leave Act and the California Family Rights Act, which provide 12 weeks of unpaid leave for people to take care of a serious medical condition of themselves or someone else. But it requires employees to have worked somewhere for a certain amount of time before they're eligible, and also doesn't apply to small businesses.
Hmm. Okay, so given that these types of losses, have existed for generations and generations, starting now, it took effect January 1, what are the big changes people are going to experience if something like this happens to them, compared to last year, 2023, to now?
So previously you had 0 protected days off for reproductive leave. You could take sick leave, but now you have up to 20 days total of leave per year. So you can only take that in 5-day increments, but there are a lot more options too. If you're, for instance, someone who is on a pregnancy or adoption or surrogacy journey and experiences multiple losses, which does happen for sure, you will be able to have more options. And if you do take this leave, your employer is mandated to keep that completely confidential.
Okay, so walk us through how it works.
So the law doesn't mandate that employers pay employees for this leave. But if you have sick time that you haven't used, you can use that to help pay for this leave. But yeah, so if you experience a loss like this, you can tell your employer that you need to take leave based on the California law of reproductive loss and event leave, and you can qualify for those 5 days that don't have to be taken immediately. They can be taken later if you want to grieve with your family in some other way within 3 months of when that event occurs. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that this does apply to both people in a relationship. What was the rationale behind that?
So when I spoke with Senator Susan Rubio, she said she wanted to reflect that both people in the relationship have experienced this loss, and that experience should be reflected.
We no longer live in the 1950s where there was one type of family. Now we know that there's families in different combinations trying to experience the love of having a family.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to, you know, you want to actually take advantage of this leave, you know, what do you actually have to show your employer?
So the law doesn't say anything about documentation. For California's bereavement law, the employer can request proof, but this law does not require employees to show proof. That said, if an employer's policy mandates that proof must be shown, then that must be followed. You know, regardless, employers can't retaliate against an employee for taking this leave if they believe that they've experienced a reproductive loss event, which is generally pretty broad. But the law itself does not mandate any proof.
Where does California compare to other states? Do other states have similar laws on the books?
So this is kind of a relatively recent phenomenon to really get reproductive loss leave in the books. But there are two states that have kind of provided a little bit of an example for California. In 2022, Utah and Illinois passed their own reproductive loss law. Utah's applies specifically to public employees, and it's 3 days, and it's part of their bereavement leave for specifically miscarriage or stillbirth. So it's much more limited than California's law. Illinois' law is a bit bigger. It allows for 10 unpaid work days, but yeah, definitely not as extensive as California's in terms of amount of days, but those 10 days can all be taken together consecutively, unlike California's. Something I thought that was interesting about Illinois' law is that employees don't have to tell their employer which event they experienced. So the proof is not required out in Illinois.
Hmm. You mentioned, and we've actually heard from State Senator Susan Rubio. I mean, tell us more about this lawmaker who authored the legislation.
So Senator Susan Rubio represents LA in the Inland Empire. She is from LA. She was born in Mexico from LA. She's a former public school teacher and the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Domestic Violence. And she has a lot of female friends. You know, she talked to me about how there's a lot of women in her life who have been through this and shared with her that they'd never told anybody that this was something that they'd experienced. And as she heard that from people, you know, she began to connect with other stakeholders and realized there was a need to normalize this conversation. Something else I'll mention about Senator Rubio that we might see down the line is she told me about a law she has in mind that would make it cheaper because it would have health plans contributing to people doing IVF, in vitro fertilization, and freezing their eggs. So she wants to make that more cost effective for people, in part because she shared with me that she comes from a family of women with cancer diagnoses, and the treatments you go through for, you know, dealing with cancer really can impact your fertility and the timeline at which you can have kids. So she wants to make that more in reach for people who may be experiencing cancer who would want to have these fertility treatments.
Hmm. Kate, I realize that this is already a state law. It's like, you know, it's a done deal. But, you know, as it was making its way through the state legislature, did it come with any opposition? And if so, what was the main argument?
The main opposition was from the California Chamber of Commerce, which argued that Californians have a lot of leave already. We do have a fair bit of protected leave in comparison to other states. And the Chamber of Commerce worked with Senator Rubio's office to get those 20 days that Senator Rubio wanted for people broken down into 5-day chunks so that an employer wouldn't have to protect somebody's job for 4 weeks while they were going through something, and instead it can be a little bit more spread out.
Kate, there are many fertility issues that people who want to become parents that they're faced with. I mean, there's a whole spectrum. I mean, there's miscarriage, there's stillbirth, learning you're unable to biologically have a child. But this type of grief, as you mentioned, and as the state senator mentioned, has long been dealt with privately behind closed doors. And it can be a lot more common than we actually think. So is this law part of a larger cultural shift that really sparked or influenced this piece of legislation?
Yeah, so it has become, the conversation about how often this happens has become more prevalent. I think people are having children later, they're delaying starting families, and this can lead to more difficulty getting pregnant, more chances of experiencing a loss like this. And so there's more conversation around it. And there's too more conversation about mental health and how that can and should be more integrated into the workplace and in workplace protection. So I think those two things are really coming together to prompt more conversation about this. I'll also say that, 42% of California legislators at the moment are female. It's a real upward trend of women joining higher office. So I think that there's more acknowledgement of women's issues, and there's more push to create laws that work for working women.
Yeah, and likely more firsthand experiences as well. Finally, Kate, there are several hundred new laws that we're all going through and learning about, and many touch healthcare. What drew you to diving deeper into this specific one?
I was surprised that this law didn't already exist, that these protections and rights for working women were not currently in existence. I was curious about what protections it would provide. And I think that, as you said, I'm really interested in the culture shift aspect, right? When there are more women in higher office, as you said, more women who maybe have had firsthand experience of this, what concerns are brought to the forefront? And how are we able to really highlight those issues? And I know people who have lost unborn children who, that's part of their life and their story forever. And I think that is becoming more acknowledged and talked about, and hopefully making more people feel seen and like they're not alone.
Thank you so much, Kate. That is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf discussing a new state law that allows employees to take up to 5 days of unpaid leave following a reproductive loss, and that encompasses miscarriage, a failed adoption, to surrogacy, an IVF transfer, as well as other fertility diagnoses. Up next, a new women's soccer team is coming to Roseville, and it will be inspiring the next generation of players. We'll learn about the formation of Iron Rose FC and what the semi-pro team has in store before it kicks off its first season this year. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento is known to have a loyal and strong fan base when it comes to soccer. Of course, there's been the years-long push to get Sac Republic FC to the MLS level, but women's soccer has also been behind a growing appetite for U.S. soccer. The U.S. women's team is ranked second in the world behind Spain, and the first-tier National Women's Soccer League also welcomed more than 1 million fans last season, breaking league records. And that excitement has trickled down to local soccer fields. Lower division teams are already in cities like Davis and Stockton, and now a new team is joining their ranks. The city of Roseville was announced as the home of one of the newest expansion teams in women's soccer. The team is named Iron Rose FC, and its inaugural season in the Women's Premier Soccer League, it kicks off later this year. And the team is also having open tryouts this weekend, January 13th. Joining us now is Evan Nudener with the Roseville Youth Soccer Club and a managing partner of Blue Ribbon Football Group, the owners of Iron Rose FC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations.
Appreciate it.
It's a big year, 2024. So I would love to just start with your background. What got you into soccer?
Great question. My mom is half Irish, so it always kind of was there. But I played all sports growing up, and I'm a big believer in a multi-sport background. So I did martial arts, basketball, soccer. Soccer stuck with me, and it felt a little different, especially when I played over in Europe at a very young age. And then a couple of moments, just having things on TV, like the 2005 Champions League from Liverpool, which gave me my love for Liverpool, really gave me hope. And I think that's kind of what the sport is about. So that's what brought me into my, I guess, 20-year on-the-field, off-the-field career.
Yeah, and your partner is also involved in soccer as well, correct? So
yeah.
It's kind of a package deal.
Oh, my God. Yeah, she's a legend. She plays right now in the NWSL for the Orlando Pride. We met in college, actually. And it's been awesome kind of growing together. I mean, in a sense that both starting out in university, taking our chances over in Europe, things working, things not, learning the off the field stuff. And now in a sense, she just re-signed with Orlando for a 3-year deal. And it's great to see the growth as we're all growing as people mm-hmm. as well. Cause now, I mean, her contract's a lot better than it was, 10 years ago. And she was able to do it all herself, right? Like she didn't need anybody else, an agent or an intermediary. She understood the business from growing in it. And, I'm excited about her season. I'm excited about all the women's soccer kind of in the coming 5 years, as there's a major growth. I think after the World Cup was pretty incredible to see. So
yeah, it can be easy to take for granted, the place that women's soccer holds in the United States now, and it's continuing to grow. But given that you, and your fiance, you started really young, and so let's say like over a decade ago, maybe 2 decades ago, is it surprising to see, kind of the footprint that it's taking up now?
It's actually, when you gave the intro, it was really interesting to hear that America is in second place. You know what I mean? It's been a long time since we were like comfortably in second place, because there have been so many legends in the American game on the women's side who kind of paved the way. At the same time, though, which is really good, that draft has brought the European game up. And so, yeah, it's great to see more on a global stage how big the footprint is, because there's always been a great footprint for women's soccer in the United States, just because American likes winners. We used to win almost ruthlessly and relentlessly in a way. And now the world is catching up, and I'm kind of excited to see our next step to mm-hmm. retake that position of number one. But in reality, I think the bigger footprint, the bigger global stage has been all over the world. For example, the Matildas, like in Australia, their jersey sells better than the men's. And
nice.
In England, the Women's Super League, they're starting to sell out men's stadiums. So it's nice to see that growth. And they mirror what we could also have hopefully the very near future.
When did you begin thinking about, going from just a love for the game, an athlete yourself, to actually moving into the business side, the managerial side of soccer?
Yeah, good question. I think playing sports and trying to be a professional is a very humbling experience. And you find out exactly who you are and what you can do very early on. on a quick kind of tangent, I grew up in like a small business. So I was always in a business sense. Like my dad taught me a lot about just the business world. And while I was playing, a couple of injuries plus, you know, just kind of tapping into that side, realized that you probably need something else. But at the same time, you realize that there's tons of opportunities within the sport to kind of continue your career. So as I was going, I caught a really bad break. Literally, I broke my ankle very badly when I was like 22. It was the first pause in my life where I was like, maybe there's something else. So I started a company while I was in Europe, and I wanted to basically extend the opportunities that I was given, whether it was university, trips, a life, culture, understanding of the world, both sides of it. And I think you could do that through sport. And so the business side of me of sport wants to just offer the opportunities that I can have, or offer the opportunities that can be brought through sport. And then it's I guess it's a testament to both of me and my fiance's lives of, you know, our lives are through sport.
Yeah.
And it's given us everything.
Yeah, it's much more than a passion or a job. It's definitely a part of your identities as well and a big part of your life. So that brings us to Iron Rose FC. I mean, obviously it is here. You know, this is the inaugural year. But what led to the formation of this semi-pro team?
A lot of things. A lot of things had to go right, in a sense, for this to happen. And it's, you know, from all of the things we've been doing behind the scenes with Blue Ribbon to the president of Roseville Youth Soccer Club reaching out on LinkedIn to ask actually about somebody else. So last year about this, maybe about 2 months ago this time, the president of Roseville Youth Soccer Club reached out to me on LinkedIn while I was getting my master's in football business in Barcelona, and was asking if anybody I knew would be interested in a position in Roseville. And took a second and I said, you know, this is a really good position. I might be interested in this. So I called him back and I was really interested in the opportunity, because Roseville, I think, offers not just in theory a blank canvas, but a very blossoming city and a really big opportunity, because I think it's where everybody's going. Obviously, the numbers could tell you it's growing in population. People are moving.
It's, I think, the fastest or one of the fastest growing areas in the state.
Exactly. There's the participation in youth soccer in the area is astounding. Even in our club, Rose Youth Soccer Club, 4,000 members. It's a mind-blowing, especially coming from New York. You know, you hope to get 200. 4,000 bought in for 40 years. We think that there's tremendous upside. But we're just one of five clubs in the area that have a really big recreational program. And I think recreation is where I started and got my love, besides the, you know, viewing the games. And it's a way to introduce soccer that maybe hasn't been introduced before, because it maybe is a little further out and the exposure isn't there. But after a couple of conversations, I knew this was the right opportunity, and I'm really glad that the board kind of bought into a new approach, because we changed a lot and it's been a big year.
How long did this take to actually become a reality? I would imagine, you know, there's a lot that happens behind the scenes to actually, you know, given this the green light in Roseville.
Oh, it was, I mean, a lot did happen. It was a couple of good calls, but when it's right, it's right. You know what I mean? We felt that the president, Kevin Stringer, he has a background in Europe, painted the picture of what it could happen. And I mean, to be fair, he is an unbelievable salesman, like top of the top. And he painted a good picture. The board supported it, and the people in the club in the city were very welcoming to open it up. And we were aligned from the beginning to create a pathway. And the whole goal of this is to recreate something in Europe, and put it in Roseville, because everything in Roseville kind of can mirror what is in Europe. A lot of young families, a lot of ambitious families, a lot of, you know, very talented people and players in all sports that are overlooked, I think, that maybe just haven't had a light shined on them. So the board, the club empowered me to make the decisions. And I've had a lot of great guidance from my group, Blue Ribbon, to help and get everything together. After that, it was paperwork, figuring things out, and we were off in the races.
What went behind the name? What's the symbolism of Iron Rose?
So in creating a brand and creating an identity with the club, you want to look to the history. And Roseville historically has been a major area for locomotion. I mean, the old city of Roseville used to be called Junction City. Mm-hmm. There is an unbelievable setup, especially in downtown Roseville, where I feel like there's a lot of culture, a lot of grit, a lot of personality, and there's a huge train scene. It's just a lot of railroads and a good feeling of, you know, I would say, you know, past and present. And I think, you know, I wish there were more trains in the world just because I love public transit, but that's the iron side of it. And you could go iron horse, but we wanted to keep that strength. And I think Roseville has a lot of strength and grit. And then the other side is the Rose. So that's like the new age of the city, of the club, of the identity. It's like old and new coming together. It's kind of the strong and beautiful. It's also two sides of our, you know, we're a men's and women's team, but it's, you know, and that's not why Iron and Rose, but there's a dichotomy of very strong, hardworking, you know, put your nose down, get things done. And then the beauty that what Roseville can become. So that's the idea behind it. So Iron Rose is a metallic rose, and we had a lot of work done on, you know, focus groups, you know, help, and finally we got to, I think, what is a beautiful brand and logo.
You mentioned that there will be a men's and women's team. That's going to come further down the line, the men's soccer team?
Yeah, there'll be a men's team in 2025, mm-hmm. But I think it was also very important for us to start with the women's. And a lot of things kind of came into place, but I think really personally there's a better crop of women athletes, people in the area, and you can see by, you know, what the players produced. I mean, Megan Rapinoe's from the area, but just a lot of good development in Placer County, in Northern California for women. And it's good to lead with that. And I think that it's always been overlooked, and especially women's soccer. So I think it was really important to start out with the women and then lead the next year with both teams. Mm.
So Iron Rose FC is going to be playing within the WPSL. That's the Women's Premier Soccer League. Tell us more about what the league is.
So the league it's really incredible because, I mean, 50% of the girls, women, who played in the NWSL Championship last year played in the WPSL. The other were international. So astounding numbers. I mean, if anybody really wants to look on the website, all the alumni that ever played, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Rose Lavelle, Tobin Heath, you can name it, just of cast. It's a very consistent, reliable league that has always housed players in the summer who have been coming back. It's always been an extension, an opportunity to play. It's always been there. Like, for example, when there's been professional leagues or not, there's always been the WPSL. It's always been consistent. It's always found its niche, and it's very comfortable where it is. For reference, Peter Wilt, who is part of the Blue Ribbon Football Group, mm-hmm. done so much for the game. He's brought 13 teams to the WPSL. I think his Chicago House Women's was his 14th, if I'm not mistaken. I hope maybe he corrects me later.
That's all good background.
Yeah, I mean, sport is a meritocracy, but it's about giving chances. And the group gave me a chance. You know, Rose was giving me a chance, and I would like to give Roseville a chance. And I'd like to give them, everybody, a chance to kind of show on a more of a national stage, especially as the city and the club is growing.
And now you're all building, you know, a well-rounded team. I mean, you still have work to do this year. You're going to be having open tryouts, I believe, this weekend. I mean, what are you looking for? I mean, I would imagine there's already a good amount of excitement to potentially try out or be part of management or coaching, given that you have like 4,000 athletes, you know, locally that are aware and are excited about women's soccer.
Yeah, and if I don't mind, the California Storm, who are also in the WPSL, they've done an incredible job to continue and like really highlight what WPSL could be, and there were a lot of data points that led us to do it based on the excitement for the California Storm, which made a lot of sense.
And they're located in Davis, right?
Yeah.
So do you think there could be like a rivalry in the future, given that you're part of the same league?
I really hope so. I think rivalries are the best part of sport, games that mean something. You know, you don't want to just show up and maybe be too friendly. I think that's a little bit of the issue that people have with the NBA, and what people really like about the NFL is that there's a sort of desperation. There's a hometown feeling, and this is Roseville's team, and I hope we can get behind it and find some reason to win, and also get behind maybe a little animosity toward, you know, now I'm not going to say an outsider, but at the same time, we have a little bit of pride for our hometown team, and in this situation.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Evan Nutter from Roseville Youth Soccer Club and Blue Ribbon Football Group about a new semi-pro women's team in soccer coming to Roseville, and is called Iron Rose FC. So let's talk about the partnership with Roseville Youth Soccer Club. How do you envision this will develop over the years?
I think it's a really important part of the growth of Iron Rose, and it's important for the growth of the city. So the city is putting in a 10-field turf complex in the west part of town, kind of showing how much the city's growing, how important soccer is. And we're the largest club by far in the area. And we think that as we're growing, as we're expanding, and to be clear, Roseville Youth Soccer Club is a volunteer-run club. And it's the most beautiful thing, because that's how it should be. Education is what we really put forth, and we put our stamp on coaches' education, player education. And as we have the education and potentially exposure of Iron Rose, we can continue to expose our coaches and players to something that maybe can be and grow their base. And at the same time, as Roseville Youth Soccer Club does improve, then of course Iron Rose will improve, because that's the pathway, right? So two hands kind of, you know, shaking each other, washing each other in a really positive way, because a club is only as good as its community. And the community is Roseville, and Roseville Youth Soccer Club is a staple in the community. So I think as Iron Rose, maybe takes the lead at this point, that'll just increase, I would say, the importance of Roseville Youth Soccer Club, that it can funnel and continue to funnel players and coaches into the first team.
Yeah, I mean, creating a strong foundation or roots to help Iron Rose FC grow, you know, when you already have such a great foundation of talent, you know, young talent and excitement.
Young talent, but also coaches. We hosted a C license last year that gave 16 coaches their C license. So I think educating players and promoting players is really important. But I think what the United States kind of lacks is coaching and experts. Experts, you know, evaluating the game, but coaches coaching the game. So if you can empower and educate coaches and put them in a situation, they have, you know, access to 20 players at a time. And it's really a better model to develop the coaches. And Roseville does that to a T. We have 200 and something coaches on the recreational side that we provide coaches education for every month. Plus we, you know, offer them sessions and support. And on our competitive side, the same thing. Directors to help our coaches be better, because fixing, you know, having people kind of almost take it out of the coach's hands and run the session and make it easy for them doesn't make anybody grow. So I would rather, in a lot of ways, develop our coaches so that, you know, they can develop our players. And that is the formula that Roseville's put together. And it's a really beautiful one, because our goal is to not only have players come from Roseville Soccer Club, but coaches and staff, because Iron Rose is not just a place for players, but executives, coaches, players, interns, for everybody to kind of develop.
What would you like people to know about tryouts this weekend?
It's come out. It should be fun. Hopefully the rain doesn't deter anybody. I know this is an area where, oh my God, it's raining.
I know.
110 degrees, no problem. But the rain,
you won't melt.
Yeah. No, come out. And if you're in the area to watch, by all means. It's completely open.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I meet the potential coaches. We're hopefully going to be announcing the head coach in the coming days. So stay tuned for that. Come out to tryouts to meet some of the people involved, because we have 5 or 6, probably more people coming out to help out in the interim. And it shows a lot of the support, but also the talent that's in the area. We have Mo Ruiz from Mad Skills, great following, great program, great product. He's helping out. He'll probably be involved in some way. Max Alvarez, who works for Roseville Youth Soccer Club, actually a Sac State alum, played at Sac Republic. He's going to be there. My fiance will be there. Omobi Okugo, who is Forbes 30 under 30, he'll be there. Come out and say hi. Meet the people. Take some pictures. And if you're a player and you want to take a chance and you're overlooked, come on by. We'd love to have you.
When does the season kick off?
It'll be in May. So
that's quick.
Hell yeah.
You have a lot to build in just like a short amount of time. Evan, thank you so much, and really excited for this new team in our area.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. We're excited as well.
And that is Evan Nettiner of Roseville Youth Soccer Club and Blue Ribbon Football Group, the ownership behind the new women's soccer team, Iron Rose FC. They're going to be holding their first open tryouts this weekend on January 13th, and their inaugural season kicks off very quickly later this year, closer to May, right? Still ahead, many people are participating in Dry January, maybe as a way to reset, save money, improve your health. But that doesn't mean you can't still have a good time. We're going to have some recommendations on where you can enjoy Dry January across Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As the saying goes, new year, new you, right? Well, for many, January is a time to get started on some new goals, which can include living a healthier lifestyle. You may have heard the term dry January before. Maybe you're doing it yourself. It is a month-long commitment to start the new year off without alcohol. For some, it's easier said than done, especially those who like to have a few adult beverages during a busy month of sports like the NFL playoffs, Kings basketball, etc. Others use the month of January to reset, reboot their bodies after what might have been an especially boozy and festive holiday season. So whether it's for health reasons or just trying to save a little bit of money, giving up alcohol doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up your social life. Benji Eagle is the food and drink reporter for the Sacramento Bee and joins us with some fun options for people who still want to have fun without the buzz. Hey, Benji.
Hey, Vicky. Great to be here.
So I am doing Dry January. It is my first time. It's going well. And I do feel like in the last year or two, at least among my friends anecdotally, you know, people have been kind of rethinking their relationship with alcohol. I mean, have you been noticing that, you know, in your reporting, checking out restaurants and bars in the area?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is something that really came out of the pandemic when people were locked down for so long. They just started rethinking their relationship with alcohol, as you said. And there's some people who are fully sober, but there's a lot of other people who are sober curious, who are more open to dry January now, or who want to take a night off and have a fun non-alcoholic drink. And I think the options have really improved as well, which makes it easier to do so.
Yeah, I've noticed at restaurants and bars, they're incorporating or embracing more non-alcoholic options, you know, whether it's a non-alcoholic beer or even something that's, you know, a little more fancy, like a mocktail.
Totally. Yeah, there's a lot of restaurants and bars here in Sacramento that have switched over and have been providing non-alcoholic cocktails, mocktails, in addition to regular cocktails. You'll see it really popular places like Iron Horse Tavern, Moss Taco Bar, all of the Irish hospitality bars and restaurants, which is the Butterscotch Den, Rochambeau, The Snug. They all have great options. Shangri-La and Fair Oaks has some really fun stuff as well. And so it's great to see that, you know, for folks who are sober for the night.
Yeah. I know that you are the food and drink reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Have you ever done like a dry January or something like that before?
I have. I did it a couple of years ago. And I think it was in 2019. So it was we were starting to see some better non-alcoholic options, but it was still pretty tough to find drinks that really felt like drinks. I didn't want to be having a soda every night when I went out to the bars because that wasn't that healthy either. And, you know, it wasn't that fun. But now there's a lot of non-alcoholic distilled spirits on the market. I think that non-alcoholic beer is better than it used to be. Non-alcoholic wine as well. And yeah, so, you know, I'm not doing it this year, but I think I would have an easier time if I were doing it in 2024 than 2019.
You gave us some options and those were all great ones. But if someone is listening to this and they're like, oh, yes, like I can actually like go out and, you know, and kind of, you know, be with friends who maybe are having a drink and then I can have a pretty cool mocktail. Where do you recommend people go?
Ooh, the Butterscotch Den is kind of the hottest park in Oak Park. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's kind of like traditionally a martini, steaks, $4 caviar bump kind of bar. But they have some really interesting non-alcoholic drinks as well. They have one called the Phony Negroni that, you know, you look at it in a glass and it looks like you're drinking alcohol, but you're having a nice kind of cocktail without the bite of alcohol, I guess. Bottle and Barlow always has 5 or 6 non-alcoholic beverage options as well on their menu. Yeah, if you're looking for a fancier kind of date night thing, I really love Localis's mocktail pairings.
They have pairings.
They do, yeah. In addition to their wine pairings, they do a mocktail pairing, which I normally get when I go there. I think the last time I was there, the wines were they looked excellent, but the mocktail pairings were things like a shot of, you know, citrus, lemon pesto whey, or kind of like a duck soup to go with, you know, your duck course, or, you know, you'd have some sparkling soda of some sort that they crafted in-house. So I thought that was really interesting as well.
Yeah, sometimes people may be kind of surprised initially, you know, by how much a mocktail can cost. It can rival the cost of an actual cocktail. But then when I actually see how it's prepared, I mean, there's a lot of creativity that goes into it. So can you just explain what makes, like, say, like a $14 mocktail $14?
Totally. Well, you know, I mean, a lot of the reason that drinks do cost so much just in the world is just because distilling is a really arduous process and you have to have a lot of equipment set up and safety parameters and things like that. So when you look at a bottle of non-alcoholic distilled spirits, they're still roughly around the price of a bottle of whiskey or a bottle of rum. And so that's how you get an $11, $14 mocktail, you know, just as you would see an $11, $14 cocktail in some of the same bars.
Hmm. One of the pop-ups last year that I saw literally, you know, pop up. It is back. It is called The Teetotalist. And I saw it on Instagram. They're going to be at Propagate, which is in like Midtown Sacramento. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So Propagate is a plant shop and The Teetotalist is a completely sober, non-alcoholic bar started by two women who are sober. And, you know, they're going to be here in the month of January at, I think, 16th or 19th and G, I believe, give or take. And it's a place for people who are sober, who are doing Dry January, who just want to have a sober drink to go and hang out. Notre Ferme is going to be doing food there as well, Little Bites, and that's owned by Allison Harvey, who is a former chef at The Kitchen and is also 6 years sober herself. And I think that, you know, it's a really great way for people to try and have some of these mocktails, have some of these non-alcoholic beers before The Teetotalist launches their brick and mortar location, which they're hoping to do later.
Oh, so they are growing.
They are. They don't have a location announced yet, but they do plan to open a brick and mortar later this year. That would be Sacramento's first 100% sober bar. Those have been popular in like Los Angeles as well, but it'd be the first one here in Sacramento. And I can say too that, you know, my partner is not doing Dry January, but she's going there tomorrow night because it seems interesting. It's different.
And they have events, too.
They have events going on as well, yeah. So they're really trying to make it a space for people to enjoy whether they are sober or just sober for the evening.
Yeah, you can play games there. I think like Sunday's like Taylor Swift night or something like that. You know, they have a whole calendar of events. Given that, obviously, this is growing because if the Teetotalist is going to be having actually like a brick and mortar, you know, later this year, do you think that this is just a fad or do you think that, you know, this is really setting the foundation for, you know, another growing, I guess, arm of the food and beverage scene?
I think it is a growing arm. I think of it sort of similar to veganism, I guess, where, you know, you have some people that are fully sober. You have some people that are fully vegan. For vegan restaurants to survive, they have to appeal to omnivores as well or vegetarians or what have you. And I think that, you know, to be a successful sober bar, you have to be interesting enough or have enough events or do something different enough that people who do drink are going to want to come in for an experience, for an evening. I do think that we'll see more and more of these kind of places emerge as people think more critically about their choices with alcohol. I think a lot of millennials who have sort of driven the craft cocktail movement as well are also getting to a point where they're getting older, they're maybe watching their health, or they're becoming pregnant, or whatever it is, they're more interested in good non-alcoholic options as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, I'm in that category. I'm a millennial. You know, it always just seems like drinks are always around, and so it became more of just like, sure, yeah, sure, I'll have a glass of wine. So why not do Dry January to actually, you know, kind of think about it, be more intentional about, you know, when you want to drink. You know, so I guess I don't think I'm alone in that. Do you think the culture of drinking is changing as well, or people are reevaluating, you know, their relationship with it?
I think so. Yeah, I think that there is a little less pressure now to drink at some of these events, you know, whether it's going out with friends for a night out or a company event. I can't speak to being 18 in college anymore, but, you know, I think that there is a little bit of a cultural shift that people are wising up a little bit. There are a lot of celebrities who are publicly sober as well. And so it's becoming, I think, I don't know, more cool, socially acceptable, whatever word you want to throw with it, for people to switch off booze, either for good or for a stint. Yeah.
There's also the business aspect to it. Do you think, I guess, down the road, or have you even heard anecdotally that, you know, maybe some bars have seen a dip in sales, or maybe is that kind of to be expected in January when everyone spent a lot of money and had a lot of fun the month before?
I think January is typically a rough month for restaurants and bars as a whole. A lot of people are making healthy New Year's resolutions that they're sticking to for 1 month, say. And so, you know, yeah, you have people going out less, saving their money more. I will say that, you know, for a lot of the bar owners I've spoke to that have robust mocktail programs, that's something for people to enjoy. It's not the majority of their sales. Yeah. You know, it's something that you can come out with your friend who might not be drinking that night and everyone have a good time. But as far as the business aspect for the bar, no, it's not a huge moneymaker for them.
You know, in the last couple minutes that we have, I want to talk about your book. I know you've already joined us about the book, but when I've been to local bookstores, you know, it has sold out. You know, I literally have seen multiple people come in asking about the book. So I am going to go out on a limb and say that it was a successful publishing.
It's been very successful, yes. My book is Sacramento Eats, Recipes from the Capital Region's Favorite Restaurants. It's a cookbook compiling 60 recipes from 60 beloved restaurants and bars, including some of the ones we talked about here. Bottle and Barlow comes to mind. And yeah, it's produced through Pediment Publishing. It sold out of all 3,000 copies that they printed within a month and change or so, but they're already on to a second printing. So there should be copies available at your local bookstore, Capital Books, Avid Reader and Davis, Ruby's Books and Folsom, things like that.
Yeah, it's one thing to have an idea, but to actually see it really just be a hit and people be incredibly receptive to it, how has that made you feel?
It's made me feel wonderful. I think the reaction has been fantastic. It has 5 stars online as far as reviews, and yeah, it's just really a great way, I think. My intention was to sort of promote the Sacramento dining scene and show everything that we have here. And I think that people have been really receptive to that. People love our local restaurants and bars, and people have been really happy with the book. So I'm really glad to see that.
Has there been some feedback that has kind of stuck with you, warmed your heart a little bit, that, you know, that was, you know, maybe particularly enriching?
The biggest thing is that people want a second edition, or they want, you know, a book about cocktails and mocktails or things like that. And, you know, asking for more is the highest compliment you can get, I think.
What's going to go into a second edition? I mean, the process of kind of canvassing the area and choosing what to put in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out if that'll be the project for me next, I guess. But, you know, I would try and include some new places. As time goes on, we'll see new exciting places pop up on the scene. There's also, you know, I included one recipe from every restaurant, but these restaurants have terrific recipes and the chefs were really forthcoming with sharing them. So we could see some repeat restaurants just with a different dish in there. You know?
I would imagine now it's pretty easy for you to know when a new restaurant pops up, or if there's a new menu maybe that a popular restaurant has come up with. But when you were first getting your start as a food and drink reporter here in Sacramento, I mean, how did you build those relationships and know where to go and what to check out and what to write about?
It took a long time, I'll be honest. You know, the Sacramento food and drink scene is really robust and there's a lot of movers and shakers. But I think the biggest thing for me was I tried to zig where others zagged, where I saw people write about sort of the bright lights in Midtown and downtown. I figured I would, you know, be interviewing those people and get access to those people. And so I would say, all right, well, let me check out Little Saigon. Let me check out Natomas. Let me check out Roseville, you know. And so I think I tried to build my base out with the folks who might have a harder time getting the spotlight otherwise. And I think that's really been a hallmark of my reporting in the 5 or 6 years that I've been on the beat.
Benji, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Benji Eagle is a food and drink reporter for the Sacramento Bee. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast, and you can also send us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.